Welcome to Cardicast, a Glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. You can become a member of New Cardigan on our website at newcardigan.org. We also have merchandise available, buy a t-shirt, and support this volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation. Today I'm here with the lovely Michaela Hart, Senior Archivist at Department of Health and Human Services Archive. And I'm going to start with the first question. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? What led you to become an archivist?
Hello, lovely Nick. I've just remembered I don't have a t-shirt yet.
Oh.
I need to do something about that. My first question about, that's the only one I didn't write any notes. Can you tell me a bit about yourself? So can we just leap through to what I became an archivist?
Because yes,
I can't remember a time before I was an archivist.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I've got three archivist origin stories, and I got really excited because I usually, we'll just tell one of them. But I thought, seeing as we've got time, I could maybe tell three.
Yeah.
And they kind of weave into each other nicely. So I started working when I left high school. I did a nursing degree. So I moved to Warrnambool, became a nurse, and got involved in student politics and got turned into one of those really annoying radical undergrads. And I worked in Warrnambool for a little while as a nurse and ended up moving to Hobart. When I was in Hobart, I got a job nursing and also spent a lot of time bushwalking and got very heavily involved in gay law reform and did a lot of activism around environment things and queer things. And that sort of took me up until my late 20s. When I was in my late 20s, then I decided to go travelling and ended up back in Melbourne and got a job at the Collingwood Children's Farm, strangely enough. So I did some community development work there. And that's where, finally, that's the preamble for the archivist stories. So I spent a blissful few years milking cows, collecting eggs, making jam, radicalising my approach to food systems and community development work, and spent a lot of time turning compost with young people and figuring out some of the structures around inner city kids. And I'd grew up in the country, so this was sort of really my first time living in the city. During that time, the children's farm was about 20 years old at that point, and they used to have their office at the Collingwood Town Hall. We got a phone call one day from the admin there saying, "You've got 20 years worth of records in boxes in our basement. You need to come and pick them up because we're going to renovate." And somehow I got picked as the staff member most likely to want to spend 6 months going through those boxes. And it had never even occurred to me that I wanted to become an archivist back then. But somebody, which was my manager, had obviously seen something in me around the need to create order out of chaos and good system work. So I spent one day a week for about 6 months doing that. And, oh God, I loved it so much. It still didn't occur to me that I could become an archivist, but I look back now and think, oh, what sort of disaster did I wreak on those records, because I didn't have any training or any experience and didn't really even know anyone to find out. Didn't actually know archivists existed, I don't think, back then. So around that time as well, then I got asked to work on a project with community gardens in the Richmond Housing Estate. The aim was to help the people that were from East Timor. They were growing the traditional herbs and vegetables in their community garden and saving the seed and sending the seed back home so that the people back home could regrow their gardens that had been trashed during the conflict. My job was to figure out the system for the seed library. And once again, I'd got handpicked out of my day job, chosen as the person most likely to want to build these complicated systems of arrangement, develop the schema for description. I don't think I'd ever felt so seen professionally. And once again, archivist origin story. And then a little bit later, I decided it was time to get a real job and do a little bit more study. And I did a master's in peace studies through the University of New England. At that point, I realised I had thought perhaps I wanted to go and work overseas and do development work overseas, but I realised I didn't want to do that as a nurse because I'd seen that structural change needed to happen rather than going somewhere and putting band-aids on things. So I did the master's so that I could really start thinking about how do you create that sort of systemic change. So I did a master's degree on food production and landmine distribution in Cambodia. So if you ever want to ask me about that.
I will do, I'm sure.
And then the third archivist origin story is that during that time I started to understand the role that archives, what archives were, what sort of records were required to, what sort of they played in peace and justice processes, and a clearer idea then of a professional pathway might have emerged then. So to fund that outrageous student lifestyle, I got a temporary corporate job, ended up lasting 5 years. So as well as I got some really excellent experience during that time of project management and just experience working in a large corporate environment, change management, those sorts of things. And then the biggest gift they gave me was a redundancy package after that 5 years that I used then to fund the first year of my master's in information management. Yay, thanks, Census.
Excellent. I relate to that idea of having a redundancy that kind of took you to the path that I wanted to take, which was when I received a voluntary redundancy at RMIT. And without it, I don't think my dream of becoming an archivist or working in a museum would ever have come to fruition. So I think thank you for redundancies when they do happen.
Yay.
And they can be very welcome and can help, you know, take you on that path that you want to take,
yeah,
which is really important. I think we need to take risks and jump out, and sometimes a redundancy can be a little bit of a safety net.
A real shock.
Yeah, it can be a shock. They can be a shock, but it's also can be a blessing in disguise sometimes, depending on your situation, I think. So we've talked a bit about what led you to become an archivist, and it's been a real, you know, an interesting journey. The next thing I want to talk about is the future. What is your vision for the GLAM galleries, libraries, archives and museums sector? Do you have a vision for the future?
I do, and I've written down tear it all down, but I don't really mean that, future employers. So I think my biggest hope, I think what we're seeing now is a real groundswell of people really keen to interrogate the structures, the colonial structures that underpin the way that our institutions were built, and having some courage to have those conversations and think about ways that we can change it. And it's really exciting for me, given what I've told you about my background, it won't come as a surprise that I'm all on board for that kind of work. And I never until now really seen a way that I can blend my political life with my work life, and a clearer path of that is emerging now too, which is very exciting. So that I watched What Does a Queer Museum Look Like?
Yes.
The other night. And it's a sort of an hour long. If you Google What Does a Queer Museum Look Like, listeners, you'll be able to watch it. But that was also really exciting for me.
I think that some part of that is we've been talking about being political in the GLAM sector. We're no longer, you know, being neutral or not being neutral. How do you see our political kind of voice as archivists? It's a difficult question, I know. There's no easy answer.
Well, a difficult question. What we were just saying before when I arrived and said that I was depressed because it's a really difficult day to situate this recording in time. Kavanaugh just got confirmed and Medicine Sans Frontières have been kicked off Nauru, and it's hard to find hope. So the thing that I'm taking courage from at the moment is around the conversations that we're having and the creating the space to build empathy. And I think that is the place where we're at right now, is to have difficult conversations and sort of long and nuanced conversations around, because there's a lot of people that have very different viewpoints, and we have to find a place within our sector for all of those people. I think it's about critiquing our privilege, and as archivists, thinking about, rather than now seeing ourselves as, like you say, neutral, that we have real power in terms of the work that we do and how the records that we are working with gets kept for how long, how it gets released, if it's being digitized, how that work is progressing, what gets chosen for digitization. There's, you know, that we could have an hour conversation on almost any of those things, and those are the spaces where we can just take time to engage with the people that we work with our communities, and to get an understanding of what their needs and interests might be.
And describing, making sure that everyone is described so that they are, you know, when we're looking at collections and you know, probably there's lots of examples of this. As archivists, how do we describe our collections in a way that everyone has a voice? I think that's a really important part of our work because it really does come down to the individual. You know, there's a choice. Everyone makes a choice in everything that we do. I think the more that we're aware of that, the better we can be as a profession in understanding the communities we work with and who the records belong to, because they're not our records. They belong to the community.
Yeah.
I really think that was a great answer to that question. What current projects are you working on? I would really like to, I know that there's lots of projects that you work on, but I'd really like to talk about, I know you've given papers about vicarious trauma, and that's something that is a really important moment in our history as and in our profession that we're looking at this. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work there?
I'm happy to do that. I was hoping you would ask me about that. So a little over, actually I wrote my first blog post on vicarious trauma about 3 years ago. I think it was in 2015. And around that time, then Nicola Laurent and I started having a conversation about maybe one day writing a paper about it. And during that time, I was working on the department's response to the Royal Commission. And one of the things that we've sort of since realised is that the professional obligations of privacy and so forth really meant that those of us that were doing that work didn't have a space to really talk to anyone around what we were doing. And I had a couple of professional colleagues that were doing the same work that I did speak to, and Nicola was one of them. The idea that we started writing a paper, it's really hard to find time to do research and write when you've got a full-time job, we realised, unsurprising. So when the Melbourne conference, the Australian Society of Archivists conference, was coming around, we decided to put in an abstract for a paper, and we did it with some trepidation because even though we knew that we wanted to talk about it and we'd spoken to a few of our closer colleagues, we didn't know how it was going to be received. And we felt like we were stepping on, or like there's some kind of archival cultural taboo around talking about our emotional responses to the records that we have, and some of them which might contain difficult material. And I heard anecdotal stories of people being told that if they can't cope with difficult material in records, they don't belong, they don't deserve to work as an archivist. And other stories of people being almost this weird hazing ritual of being shown the most difficult thing in a collection away on their first day on the job, kind of, you know, it's some really problematic things that have happened to people in the past. And then also the casualisation of the work that I'll mention a bit later. But so Nicola and I ended up getting 90 minutes rather than 45 because the person we were supposed to be presenting with couldn't make it. So we gave our paper and then we not closed the doors, but you were moderating that session, Nick, I know, but we asked people to stop tweeting and turned off the recording and created that space within the Australian community for us all to have a conversation. And it was the first time that we'd had that conversation. It was, I think you'll agree, a really profound and moving time, real conversation to have. And lots of people shared some of their experiences, and people have took from that, they took it back into their workplaces. And I'm still hearing stories of how people have taken those recommendations around, we need to talk about vicarious trauma in our workplace, we need to acknowledge it as a workplace safety risk, we need to find ways as a professional community to share in a safer space what our experiences have been without revealing confidential sort of nature of our work. We desperately need some qualitative research to be done.
Put it out there for our listeners.
Put it out there. If somebody wants to do a master's degree or a PhD or something on it, it really needs some good research. Then we got an opportunity. We saw a call for paper, I think it was a week before Christmas last year, that the North Carolina Society of Archivists were going to theme their annual conference around Michelle Caswell and Marieke Sifor's paper, Feminist Ethics and Archival Practice. It has been wildly referenced in lots of our other conversations. And we quickly messaged each other and went, it's in March, it's going to be crazy busy next year, but let's try and go. So we went to North Carolina and gave an adapted sort of, we talked about it, talking about the Australian context, but also went there saying, we want to start having these conversations globally and start thinking about how other archivists around the world are also responding. We knew that conversations were happening in America and we didn't want to silo ourselves. We wanted to make sure that we were all having the conversations together. That was really an amazing conference. Every paper that every presentation that I heard blew my mind. It was a really fantastic time. Being in the South, in the American South, and hearing some of the stories, you sort of realize how transferable the conversation around vicarious trauma is. And, you know, there were archivists who were telling us stories about having records of slavery in their archive and Ku Klux Klan. And while the content of some of the archival material is slightly different to what we've been working with, we realise that the experience is universal for us. And just recently, we've just came back from Glasgow, the Archives and Records Association UK conference, and we gave the paper. We've developed it further again and started really thinking about a more nuanced approach in terms of looking at vicarious trauma and empathisation together and having a sort of more holistic view so that we can think about the ways that we can transform our experience to actually influence change in the way that we do work. And a lot of that is around having time for conversations with people, getting a better understanding, using our experience and understanding to develop a more empathic archival practice.
I think it's important that we're having this conversation here today for CardiCast as well. So hopefully our listeners, I'm sure there's listeners that would empathise or have their own experiences. So I'm sure they can find your papers, either recordings mm-hmm. or online at those conference websites. Is that right?
Yes, the Glasgow paper was recorded. It's on the ARA website now. I can tweet the link to it
Excellent.
Again later if you
That'll
like.
Be fantastic.
Well, our next task is to write it up into a paper, hopefully for publication sometime next year.
Excellent. So that'll be the next stage of a really interesting journey. I'm sure it's been maybe in some ways cathartic to go have those conversations in different locations, but I'm sure there's a bit of self-care that would need to take place as well when you're sharing and hearing other people's vicarious trauma stories of what they've experienced. It's important to look after yourself as well. So the next question I'd like to ask you is about your passions at work and outside of work, because I guess talking about self-care, you need to, you know, it's important to have other things besides our work in GLAM, which can be all-encompassing. And is there anything you'd like to share?
I'm working on a project now to digitise the audiovisual records from the department. So, and we've done photographs, maps and plans last year, and I'm now embedded in all the audiovisual. So we've got 100 odd years worth of, we've got 28 different formats of film reels, VHS tapes, pneumatic tapes, right up until the sort of the more modern formats. And that's been a real learning curve for me in terms of working through the digital preservation and the digitisation for that. And doing it within a large government department has been interesting. On Friday, so the plan is to make as much of it available as possible to the people that were in it. So we've got some of the recordings from outings from children's homes and institutions, Christmas parties and trips to the zoo and things like that. So working through all of the confidential, all the privacy and copyright restrictions and all those sorts of challenges to make some of that available. Mostly the challenge has been about making sure that it gets preserved. So we know that we've got the 2025 deadline where audiovisual material needs to be digitised by then. So that was our urgent. That's how I got the funding. But it means that I get to do awesome things. Like on Friday, I was looking through processing some recordings from sessions that one of the institutions had a series of work that I won't describe. But as people did in the 70s and 80s, if you were around then, you'll remember that you used to shove any tape if you realised there was something on telly that you wanted to watch. And the staff in the institutions did that sometimes too. And so as I was looking through processing these recordings, I found a David Attenborough Life on Earth episode from 1979, and suddenly, like, super hot David was on my screen, and it was fantastic. it was interesting, this quickly listening, some of the language that got used around then. He was talking about upright man, and he was referring to Neanderthals as, oh, I can't remember. It was quite shocking and offensive to my sort of now ear anyway. But
he wasn't calling them cavemen, was he?
Almost. Ape men. Yeah, so it was really interesting to see in my lifetime how great that's, how quickly it's think sort of language changes, and it made me realise that's constantly evolving, and that's another thing that we as archivists have to think about, is the way that language is changing.
That's very true.
You wanted me to talk about life outside of archives, yes, too, didn't you?
Yes.
I'm a rock nerd as well as all the other usual things. So if I get stopped at customs and asked, what have you got in there, rocks? The answer's probably yes. After Glasgow, I took my family down to Dorset and we went fossiling. That was pretty awesome. I was very happy pottering along the beach looking for weird ammonites and tektites and things like that. So I found some stash to bring home.
You got them through customs?
Got them through customs all right. Yep.
Oh, I think it's interesting to talk to people working in glam that, you know, our own personal collection. So it'd be interesting to see your growing fossil collection and other, if you're interested in minerals and other things, is that right, as well, in collecting? Yep. Final question. What's your favourite book, film, exhibition, podcast, conference, piece of music? What's your favourite thing at the moment?
Sarah Ahmed's Living a Feminist Life is the book that I'm just kind of carrying around with me everywhere at the moment. It's
a recommended read. And it's something that sort of, is it something that you read a lot, or do you read a lot of feminist literature, or is it something that just comes in amongst a lot of things that you're reading?
I do read a lot of feminist literature. I find that especially at this time in our world, it gives me some structure and comfort. And Sarah Ahmed particularly provides some really good practical advice. She talked about citation as a feminist practice, for example, and if you're working in the academic space particularly, you know, thinking about who you cite or citation practices when you're working.
And do you share this with your colleagues at work as well?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
And now we're sharing it with the world through Cardicast, which is fantastic. Yay. Hopefully listeners have a read as well. And follow Michaela on Twitter at Morty Girl, which we can share in our show notes. I'd really like to thank you, Michaela, today
thank
for coming
you
in.
For having me.
Thanks so much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this interview. Subscribe to Cardicast on iTunes and review us. Keep an ear out for more Cardicast episodes and visit our website, newcardigan.org.